Welcome to Financial Perspectives, the podcast. Join the team at Foster Group and our expert guests as we explore a variety of subjects that could impact your financial life. We will cover timely economic and financial market news, a wide range of personal financial planning ideas, and investment topics. Ultimately, we want to encourage educated optimism and do our best to provide valuable insights to help you navigate your financial journey with confidence. Please stick around at the end for important disclosure information. More information about Foster Group can be found in our ADV brochure at fostergrp.com.
Hello and welcome back to Financial Perspectives. In this episode, we're fortunate to have a special guest to help us understand what's happening with the seemingly ubiquitous and ongoing AI revolution. You know, AI, artificial intelligence, it's a part of almost every newscast every day, and every company is touting what they're doing with AI that will make them better and more profitable. For those of you who've been around long enough, this can sound a little like the dot-com era of the 1990s. We'll see. The question that keeps evolving for many is, what is artificial intelligence and what are the possibilities and opportunities and cautions? Well, to help us understand some of that, I'm happy to welcome Stephen DeMann. Stephen is a vice president at Dimensional Fund Advisors in Austin, Texas, in the Global Client Group, where he helps financial advisors think about how to advance their business and serve clients better. And he's a leading thinker about how advisors and others are utilizing artificial intelligence. As interesting to me is Stephen's background as a civics teacher with Teach for America, as well as his master's degrees, including an MBA from the University of Texas and a master's from Stanford in policy and organizational leadership. Somewhere during all that, he managed to work for a time on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., where he was known for always carrying a copy of the U.S. Constitution in his pocket. So, Stephen, welcome to Financial Perspectives, and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Kent. It's an honor to be here and be with you.
Yeah. We're glad to have you. Before we dive into AI, though, I watched your video about carrying a pocket constitution around Washington, D.C., and I just think our audience would be interested in that part of your story. Could you just share a little bit about that?
Sure thing. It's a real nerd story, but when I was in high school, I went to Constitution Camp as an impressionable 16-year-old, and I came back. I really loved Constitution Camp. We talked and learned about the Constitution and debated its ideals and principles, and I came back and I had very tremendous teachers in school. I was very lucky, great teachers. I grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, and my civics teacher, Mr. Rieger, I remember he carried Puck Constitution and he handed us each one, and I was fresh on the heels from Constitution Camp, and he said, "You see this? You can read it in one sitting. It's the guiding principles of our country. It's not perfect. It strives to be more perfect. And if you wanted, you could carry it with you." And I had just come from Constitution Camp. I had in my hands a Puck Constitution, and I decided from that point forward, I would always have it, carry it with me. And so I have ever since. I go to the gym, I carry my Constitution with me. When I worked, you know, lived in DC for 10 years, I carry my Constitution with me. And so it's always been a part of me, and the ideals it represents are very important to me. And I'm very grateful to live in a place and live in our country that has a guiding framework like this, and know that there's a lot that we're doing to try to preserve and make it, our union always better. So
that is so amazing. A Constitution Camp. When you mentioned that, I thought that's one I have not heard of. So really great that existed. I hope it still does. Hey, one of the stories you told around that Constitution, though, is this is not the original one that you've got right there. You had a number of them signed by some pretty interesting people.
That's right. Every time I meet someone I really respect or who's living up to the ideals embedded in the Constitution, I'll ask them, "Would you mind signing my Constitution for me?" And so I have a collection of hundreds, literally hundreds of these that have been signed over the years. I've got more than 8 Supreme Court justices have signed my Constitution. I've got 2 U.S. presidents. I've got many members of Congress and other notable figures. And then even in Dimensional, working at Dimensional Fund Advisors, I've got Nobel laureates like Gene Fama and Myron Scholes and Bob Merton. They've all signed my Constitution as well. Senator Bill Bradley, who has an office in our building, he's signed my Constitution. So, it gets quite a lot of, I have to replenish it quite often.
That's a great story. In the video, there's a picture of the stacks of them. I just thought that was so So cool. Well, thanks for sharing that. That's fantastic. So let's talk about artificial intelligence, kind of changing the subject here a little bit. When we approach this subject, I think it'd be helpful to describe what it is, you know, what kinds of technologies it includes. It seems like it's growing in its kind of scope. So give us some background on how we got here, maybe some history from the history teacher.
Happy to start. I mean, the origin of it really starts with Alan Turing and the Turing test of, in terms of what we think of as artificial intelligence today. And in the 1940s, or early 1950s, there was a famous parlor game where men and women would be in a room and they would send a man and woman behind a curtain. And then us in the main room would write questions. We'd send them to those guests, and we would try to guess who was a man, who was a woman, based on the responses that came back. And Turing thought, what if I could put a human and a computer behind the curtain, and we send it questions, and then we try to guess who was a human versus who was a machine, and who could imitate how could we get a machine to imitate a human? And that is very important, because that's the origin of getting computers or machines to think like humans, to process in the same way humans do. So that's 1950 when he writes his famous imitation game, the Turing test paper. He's also very famous because he helped break the Enigma device, the Enigma code, which was very, you know, saved countless lives in helping us in the war, in World War II. But regardless, he was the first one to, how can we get a computer to think like a human? So fast forward a few years at Dartmouth University over the summer. It's a quiet summer at Dartmouth's campus in New Hampshire. And a group of academics at that time were on the forefront of thinking about getting computers. And this time, computers were not what we think of today as computers. They were big, tubular, big as a room, you know, that we're in right now. And they thought that they coined the term artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence is a big tent thinking of the science of making intelligent machines. What happens next, though, is what they called a cold front within artificial intelligence, because the computing power of the day just could not handle a lot of the fantastical ideas that the leading academics had. So you go through a winter, really, within artificial intelligence, until you start to get to machine learning and then deep learning. And what these are is, with computing power increasing, now we're able to do so much more in terms of training technology to have neural network, to have networks that act like our brain acts, essentially making connections the same way synapses fire in our brain. Now, that is, we couldn't do that 30, 40 years ago, but we could do that today with quantum computing. So that was incredibly big shift. And then in 2017 what we're now talking about now with this ChatGPT. Google in 2017 developed what's called the Transformer. And that is what led to generative AI, which is what ChatGPT is using, these large language models. So all this hype in the last 3 years, or 2.5 years, really is born out of this Transformer, which essentially is able to take large amounts of information, synthesize it, make those synapses, those connections, and predict what words or what should come next based off of the prompt that you give it. So it's been an evolution, but it's really taken off lately. Since ChatGPT was unveiled to everyone in November of 2022.
I saw an article just this morning, actually, in preparing, that would say that OpenAI, the developer of ChatGPT, may become the largest startup company ever. Wow. So it's had such incredible growth in terms of its value. I mentioned in the intro, and you just kind of alluded to it a little bit, that some of the current hype factors kind of remind me of the dot-com era, the internet, the second half of the 90s, when it felt like anything attached with dot-com in its name, you know, companies' values were going up, and everybody was thinking, this is the thing that will now, you know, change the future forever. it was a lot of overhype. I mean, some of those things later, you know, we've had a lot of changes due to the internet and the application. But in the areas of AI right now, where do you think, well, are we overhyping, or where might we be doing that? What are we maybe missing?
Yeah, no, I would point us to Amara's Law. Roy Amara was an academic thinker, philosopher in terms of technology and how it's adapted to the future. And his main thesis is that we tend to overestimate an effect of technology in the short run and underestimate the effect in the long run. And, you know, as a history teacher myself, like if we look at a picture of New York Fifth Avenue in New York on Easter morning in 1900, for example, what you would see in that picture, if I could transport you there, you would see a sea of horse-drawn carriages and maybe one tiny automobile, because the automobile was just starting to make its way into the picture. And if I put you in a time machine and put you on that same street, Easter morning, 1913, Fifth Avenue, New York City, you would see a completely different picture. You would see a sea of automobiles and one singular horse-drawn carriage. So to say that there's a lot of hype, I think is true. There is a lot going on. We are following Amara's principle. We're overestimating now. Oh my gosh, this is just going to, everything is going to change. But that being said, when you have a new technology and barriers to entry start to go down, like more and more people have access to this tool, the network effect is stronger now with a more connected world. And so you have, you know, the same thing with the horse to the car. You know, the car was faster. It still got you from point A to point B. It was cleaner, didn't have, you know, manure to have to clean up. It was more flexible. So ChatGPT and these tools have a lot of those same principles. Now, what will the world look like in 13 years? I don't know. I can't predict the future, but I would just pump the brakes a little bit on a lot of the hype that's out there, because we tend to do that as human beings. You know, we overestimate in the short term.
Yeah, I love that. I was thinking about that. You know, we're talking to you today. You're in Germany. Yep. We're here in Iowa. And I can remember growing up, this kind of aged me a little bit, but I remember watching the Jetsons. And on the Jetsons, you know, there was a watch that George would wear, and he could talk to, you know, people. And I'm thinking, you know, when we first had the internet in the 90s, it seemed like, wow, a lot of hype, don't know what's going to happen. But the long-term application, the fact that we can have this conversation today, basically live in two different parts of the world and streaming, even if there are little glitches once in a while in the connection, the technology is amazing. And I think, you know, initially in the 90s, people maybe overestimated how fast that was going to happen. But here we are today in 2025, and really, you know, through the pandemic, the steep curve of development just in this kind of technology alone, and what it's allowed people to be able to do in terms of having meetings, different ways it impacted travel and business. It's amazing. Just amazing.
So well put.
We'll see what happens.
We're not in the flying cars like the Jetsons yet.
But. Yeah. Maybe, although I hear about that, but we'll see. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So we have this kind of AI broad awareness taking off with the release of OpenAI's ChatGPT, as you mentioned. Now it's on version 5 of that, I just saw. It's free, available to everyone with a browser. What does this kind of tool actually do? I mean, where has it led at this point, do you think?
Yeah, so what's important to know about this tool is, one, it's not the only one out there. It's probably the one that gets the most notoriety. Yeah. Google has a version called Gemini, Anthropic has Claude. Like they're different large language models that are out there. And what they do is they scrape and collect everything that's written out there on the internet that's available. And this is a little bit controversial, right? Because news sources like Wall Street Journal, New York Times are saying, hey, you can't take our articles without permission. There's still early innings around what's the ethical considerations of the use of a lot of content that's out there. Also, I mean, you could spend 15 minutes on the internet and realize that there's some stuff out there that's probably not, you know, things that you want to base every, a lecture off of. And so you have to approach that with caution too, knowing that everything that the inputs that it's using are not perfect, and they are relying on things that are, you know, Reddit forums and things that people have written and posts, and those are laden with different perceptions and bias, and there's a lot there too. So it's not perfect, but it is uncanny its ability to take in this information and then predict what is the next best word or sequence of words based off of the prompt that you give it. And that's what these tools like ChatGPT and Gemini are doing, is they're predicting. So if you give it, you know, if it sees peanut butter and jelly blank, it knows, because it's read everything that said peanut butter and jelly sandwich, it knows that sandwich is probably the next best word there. In the sequence.
I think that probability aspect is really, that's an important thing to keep in mind, is like, this is it's a very fast statistical probabilistic model. So when you're saying predicting, it's not like it's going to happen or that it's certain. It's just saying, hey, based on all these inputs that it has taken in and processing, it's saying the most probable next thing or the most probable thing is X. But it's not mm-hmm. telling you if that probable next thing is, well, there's a 51 to 49, or if there's a 75 to 25. It's like, well, it's the most probable thing. And then this is where I think there's a little bit of a human judgment factor that's still really important, just because what you said there, all the data that's being scraped and taken in, some of it's information that you'd go, well, I just don't agree with that information. That's more of an opinion or something like that. It's taking that opinion and putting it into the... The other thing I've read some really funny stories about are what they're calling hallucinations, where it's almost as though the software engine will just, if it can't fill in a blank, it'll just make something up to fill it in.
That's exactly right. That's
which
exactly
is amazing,
right.
It's, you know?
yes. Its goal is to please. We had an instance with a client, a dimensional financial advisor, was doing research. This is in Canada, and he was asking ChatGPT about the five-factor model and different papers, and he was like, I'm related to Dimensional's investing philosophy. What are the papers that are out there related to this? He's asking ChatGPT. And one of the papers that it produced was by Marlena Lee the time researcher at our, at Dimensional. Uh-huh. And they sent it, they said, can we get a copy of this paper? And we're looking at it like, we haven't seen this paper before. And what's this? Where did you see? And I mean, a full paper title, citation, date, everything. And that was a purely made up hallucination of, ChatGPT gone wrong, gone rogue, making up a citation. So even if you ask it, like, what are your sources? And it spits out something that looks very legitimate. Even then, you should question. My decision tree is always, do I need this to be factually accurate? So if I'm looking to just generate creative ideas or, and I don't need truth, that's one thing. But if the answer is yes, I need to be factually accurate, then the second question you ask yourself is, am I an expert enough to know if what it's telling me is correct or not? Because if I need to be factually accurate, I need to be able to decide, yes, that's correct or not. And I've had many hallucinations too. I always like to analyze what happened on today's date in history, and the number of times it tells me something that I'm a former history teacher, so I know, like, hey, Gettysburg didn't happen on this, in May, happened in July. And so I'm like, wait a second, what's going on? Why are you telling me that? And I'll correct it, and it'll say, oh, I'm sorry, and I got that wrong. And it'll be polite about the error, but it gets them wrong.
Everything
sometimes.
With a grain of salt, reliability wise. I remember Marlena actually telling that story. And she was like, I didn't write that paper. I don't know what it was, just like, I don't even know what they're talking about. That was incredible. So there's some terms like generative AI, a little bit, we've been talking about that. But then there's this idea of agentic AI. People talk about agents. We're even seeing it on television commercials. I want an agent, and they're making fun of it. But it's It's something where you can actually tell the AI to do something for you. I mean, beyond just write something, it's like, hey, I need this list or whatever. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, I know you, you've begun to use it that way. How does that work for you?
Yeah, so, and that's, you're right, you nailed it. The evolution in this, in the generative AI space is using these tools as now agents. And so you'll hear that term agentic AI. And similar to when someone just says AI, when someone says agentic AI, you really want to ask them a little bit more to be like, tell me more about what you mean by that. Because the true driver behind agentic AI is having the large language model or the tool that's underneath, like the OpenAI, the ChatGPT, act on your behalf. It's just as you said. So whether it's, hey, I'm planning a trip to Germany and I would like, you know, to know, here are my interests, here's what I like to do. Can you give me some options and then rate those options and then actually plan out a week's itinerary? And so right now it can spit out and plan out the itinerary. Agentic AI would actually call and book all the experiences in a timely, in a scheduled way, factor in travel. You know, it basically is operating like a full person with interacting with other tools. Now that is, we're not, that's definitely, we're in the hype area of that. We're not fully, you know, but there are more and more cases of organizations trying to lean more into agentic AI to see what can, how can we get the tool, the language model to do more and interact more with maybe a human overlay, just checking to make sure everything's going as according to plan.
Yeah, it's kind of how much rope do you want to give it, I think, a little bit right now in terms of, you know, at what point are you comfortable saying, make these arrangements for me, and here's my credit card number?
Yes.
It's like, wow, okay, how much responsibility or, you know, autonomy am I going to give this thing? It's a...
I think it's interesting thought, but I still, too, yeah, I'm a big... The way I use, you know, and it's interesting how different people use these tools. So Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, has talked about what they see in their research is that folks in kind of call it 40 plus tend to use it like Google. And they go in and they say, you know, just the same type of questions that you would ask, like what type of, you know, tree is this? Or what type of, you know, yeah, any question you would ask in Google, you would, people are using, that's how they're using ChatGPT. And then folks in their, let's say, call mid-20s and mid-30s are using it more for planning and help me create a meal plan and a little bit deeper level of, you know, help me create an exercise routine or help me plan a trip or help me think through a home remodel and all these different layers and steps. And that's another layer. But what's interesting is the Gen Zers and the Zillennials and these folks that are, 18 through, the early 30s, the way they're using it is more like a day-to-day life coach, therapist, decision maker, and in some instances relying really heavily on like a dependency on these tools for just like, what should I wear today? How should I respond to this? What should I say to this? You know, what, how do I live? and that has deep implications that, I can't prognosticate on, but it is something interesting to think about. How am I using the tool? Am I using it just like Google? Am I doing it a little bit more? Or am I like every day relying on it? It's an interesting self-assessment.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things, there's a lot of talk about self-driving cars in this one. So, think about, okay, how is this working? Is this going to change the way that we drive, do you think? Or maybe we won't drive or get, you know, it'll run our getting around. I think, you know, it kind of behind that is a little bit, what is it going to displace? What human activity is going to be displaced by the AI, whether good or bad? You know, is it going to change certain jobs? Might disappear, other jobs might appear. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I do. And I think it's similar to, you know, go back to my, you know, early analogy of the automobile and the horse and buggy. Like in 1900, you didn't need to know how to drive a an automobile. And in 1913, you didn't need to know how to drive a horse-drawn carriage, right? So there were jobs that were changed. And we've been through, that's just one example, but we've been through lots of innovation and shifts as a society before. So I wouldn't get too scared, but I would say, look, it's, you know, in 1900, you didn't need to know how to, since you didn't need to know how to drive a car, there wasn't as much pressure to actually learn how to drive a car. But by the time it got to 1913, you should have hopefully learned a little bit. So that's my kind of call to action, I would say, is, you know, test these tools out a little bit. Don't totally shoo them away. But it's, you know, it's not to say that every job will be safe. I think it's not a good prediction there.
Yeah. Yeah. With technology, you know, oftentimes it displaces some work, but at the same time, it creates new kinds of work. So mm-hmm. you think about the data gathering and linking all the data sources together and then filtering data. So, okay, what kind of data am I going to let go through here? That's going to be both sides of that. You know, usually technology ends up, it does help with productivity. It also creates new opportunities for things in the future.
Well put. Yeah. Well put.
So for those of us old enough to remember the 1968 film, 2001 A Space Odyssey, this is dating me terribly. The computer HAL, which was kind of this early idea about AI, it took over the ship. It removed Dave from command. I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that. In the Terminator series, another one, you know, so this is this imagination about what AI can do in a bad day. Skynet does that on a global scale, ultimately kind of warring against humans. So we've talked, you've kind of alluded to this, but what do you see as the cautions? What should we be on the lookout for as this tech becomes just more widely adopted or more available and used?
Yeah, there's short-term and long-term considerations. I think short-term, for sure, the hallucinations, any bias, just factual accuracy. Those are we all. Anytime you're using one of these tools, your antenna should be up on that. I think when it comes to image generation, the sophistication of these tools is quite. I mean, the ability to detect what is real and what is not, it's even hard for AI to detect what is AI and what is not. So we really, that scares me a little bit when anytime I'm consuming content or information of just like, you know, I don't want to always be questioning, is this real or is this fake? And I think the more realistic, especially the image generation and voice deep fakes are, like, it's scary. My wife, she took my dimensional headshot and she transformed it using AI to have, you know, me give a pitch that's talking and animated. And I'm just like, unbelievable. And then she said, have a blonde woman, because my wife's blonde, you know, she said, have a blonde woman come in and give him a kiss on the cheek. And this woman comes into this room and gives me a kiss on the cheek. And I react like this in the video. And I can send you the video. you can share it with others. But I mean, it's just unreal, the realistic nature of that's just from a screen grab of a photo. So I think that's all real. And we need to be vigilant about that. The other thing is, you know, scammers that are out there are taking advantage of these tools being available. And that means being able to, you know, it's not like the Nigerian prince email that you get that's riddled mm-hmm. with typos, right? Like, now this stuff sounds real, and with just a little bit of information, it can, you know, sometimes there was a client we were working with in New York whose their daughter was on a ski trip. She had posted about it on Instagram, and these bad actors, these scammers, took clips of her voice, duplicated her voice from Instagram, called the parents using her voice, knew her itinerary, everything, and scammed them out of money. So no longer my voice is my password will be enough. You'll need safe words. You'll need different levels of protection, dual authentication, different ways to guardrail yourself against that. So I'm an idealist and optimist at heart. So I hate to dwell on the the kind of scary stuff, but it is important to be aware and be vigilant.
Yeah, I think that's really, really helpful. I know in our industry, even we've had some stories now, they've started to emerge of, you know, a deep fake voice calling, you know, asking for personal information or asking for access to assets or whatever it might be. And you know, you realize, boy, you have to have multiple levels of authentication there, just kind of as a, for those who are listening to us today, you know, that idea of multi-factor authentication, whether it's something coming independently to your phone or questions or keywords that really are kind of randomized, the kinds of things that couldn't be maybe as predicted, those are going to be increasingly important when you're especially when you're just even a little bit unsure about the voice you're hearing on the phone and saying, is this really the person I'm talking to?
I think that's a great reason to have another and a financial advisor, because if you're a client that gets a phone call like that or gets an email like that, call your advisor and just get a gut check from them and say, hey, is this legitimate? Can you, you know, because that not everyone has that trusted advisor that they can call when there's something like that. And I think, you know, beyond diversified asset allocation and, you know, all the important, you know, competent things that advisors do, I think this is a trusted resource and a good time to reach out to an advisor.
Yeah, that idea of you initiating a phone call to a number that you know will connect you with a real person that you can talk to, as opposed to something you don't know how that got initiated with you. I just, you know, so many good warnings about that. This is just another one, I guess, you know, hey, it just pays to you initiate the contact and make sure you're talking to the person you think you're talking to, even if it's just a check. Yeah. You just use it just a check. So okay, so I tend to be a little, I think over time, you know, human beings want to solve problems. We've talked about this on past podcasts here. So I like this idea of educated optimism. And education includes kind of understanding the good and the not so good. But then I thinking that humans are going to solve problems, or we're going to learn how to use this tool. And it's, you know, hopefully going to be a net benefit over time. We'll learn to use it well. So if we want to get some experience with AI ourselves, kind of, you know, let's say entry level, how could we start using it and testing it out? Where would you recommend that a person begin if they want to get a sense for what's possible and how it might help them personally or professionally?
Yeah, so I would go to your, I would start with one of the large language models that we've been talking about, either Gemini, which is Google's version, or ChatGPT, which is through OpenAI. I'd be careful when you're downloading an app on the App Store, if that's how you normally get something, just make sure that the app you're downloading is the official version of ChatGPT, because people have gotten really creative. They'll have logos that look exactly the same. It'll be called something very similar, and it might even be called ChatGPT. And then, you know, it just looks a little different. So just make sure that it's by OpenAI, that it's got lots and lots of, you know, I think currently it, you know, has hundreds of thousands, if not millions of positive reviews. So just gut check that. Again, that could be a good time to, like, with someone else, is this the right thing that I'm downloading? Because I've had it before where family members have shown me and I'm like, you're using something that's taking more of your data than it is. It's not the best.
Right.
Helping you. So first, you know, get one of those tools. And then before even you use the pay version of either one, I would test it out, some of the ways you can use it. And you will see, just like any new technology, the more you use it, the more refined you'll get. One kind of cheat sheet way I approach it is I think of role, task, outcome. So here's how I want you to act. That's how I always start it. I always tell it, I want you to be, like, if I'm going into a big presentation, I'll say, I want you to be the world's greatest public speaking coach. Okay, so I tell it, here's what I want you to be. And I usually say, I want you to be the best. I want you to be the world's greatest. Or here's what I want you to, you know, an expert in this. You're the world's greatest expert in this. And then the task is, I want you to help me prepare. I have a big talk and I want you to coach me through this preparation. And then and the outcome is, I'll give you my introduction. And you'll give me some pointers on how to make it smoother, more efficient, more concise. And so you've given it a role, a task, and an outcome. That is really helpful. If you want it to be really brief, you can say no yapping, and you can use those words, no yapping, and it'll be more concise and get it down to under, 300 words. And you can say that, I want it to be under 300 words, or I want it to be this, or, don't begin until I say no or stop. And so you can really engage with it. And a lot of the examples I'm giving are using the voice feature, which
I was going to say, when you say you tell it to do something, how are you telling it?
Yes. Yeah. So I'm a big fan of this, and not everyone, I'm not saying everyone needs to do it this way, but it's just easier for me to dictate. And the newest version of ChatGPT-5, this is available for all, both free and paid users. But there's two different ways you can dictate. You can dictate using the button that's the wavy squiggly like a microphone. So basically you're talking to it and it's transcribing exactly what you're saying into the text box. So think of like a doctor, talking, and it transcribes the notes. So I do that quite a bit. And then the other one that I love to do while I'm driving is the actual voice mode, which is another button that's right next to the microphone. And that is where it just talks to you like we're talking right now. And that has been much improved, even in the latest version. They're always improving it. That's the other thing about these tools. The version we're using today is going to be the slowest, dumbest version in history, right? Every day it's getting better. And so that's the version I think is a great way to test it out and just talk to it. My wife gives me a hard time. She's because I talk to it a lot. She's like, oh, go ask your girlfriend. She calls her my girlfriend because the voice is a feminine voice, because she knows it all. But it's pretty amazing in terms of how it can be a coach and how it can help me improve if there are things that I'm working on and little things for like parenting stuff. Like, hey, my daughter's really struggling with going to bed and she's negotiating a lot with nap times. Like, what are some strategies? I want you to act as the world's greatest parent coach. Help me handle nap time negotiations or bedtime negotiations. Like, what are some tactics or strategies I can try? And it'll, and I don't have to do everything, but it'll, bit out of some that I can try.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. The idea of what, there's this word prompt, what are you asking it to do? And then how much definition for the task are you asking it to kind of stay within? Because even in a question like that about, give me some advice on maybe some nap time, there's so many different approaches to parenting. It's like, well, you may just get kind of one channel of this way. And you might say, what else? Are there any other things you might, or give me some things that are, this is a possibility. This is a possibility. They might seem different. My head just kind of spins on this stuff because of the variety of data or the way different people would come at the same problem with different answers. And depending on what data source it's accessing, you're going to kind of get its spin in a sense on that based on the data it has available to it. So,
exactly. And that's why those of us that, know what it is to discern, we're at an advantage. Then I'm worried about this a little bit with my children as they grow up, because they're not going to know a world pre these tools, right? They're just going to grow up where this is going to be commonplace to engage with these tools. So they like asking it a question and getting a response back, like it takes experience and knowledge to know, there's different types of techniques and styles. And so just because it says, let them cry it out is one method, it doesn't mean that that's the only method that's there. So it's a good point. And it can get all of our heads spinning here pretty easily.
Man, for sure. Well, my head is spinning because this is one of those that just gets it going. So we can't talk about everything, but it just... In closing here, just before we wrap up, any last words, Stephen? What thoughts would you kind of leave us with as we consider the future of and kind of with AI? It's almost like a question of what do you find most interesting or promising as you kind of look at the future of this thing?
Well, I share your optimistic nature of humanity, and I do think that there's going to be a lot of great that comes from these tools. I mean, in medicine alone and scientific research, I mean, diseases will be cured, and how we approach, you know, endemics and different challenges in society, like that, there will be good that comes to this, no doubt. And so I'm very hopeful for those interventions and the evolution of the tool in that way. Now, what they're going to be, I don't know yet, but I do feel confident that these tools have capabilities that we, just working, you know, individually or conjunction in assistance with these tools, will provide a lot of good. But I think for those of you that are listening, the fact that you are curious, you're engaged in this enough already to be listening, I'd lean into that. And many of you maybe have tested out this tool already. And so I'd say just keep going at it. I'd ask others, how are you using the tool? Ask your friends or your parents or your children, you know, both directions, if they're using these tools, how are they using it? Because you learn from others. And then I would say the more you practice and engage with it, like I said, the more comfortable you'll get. Just be cautious. Just proceed with caution. Don't rely on it to fix, you know, everything or do everything for you. But you'll see that the more you get used to it, the more comfortable you'll be engaging these types of tools. And then if you want to go 2.0 and go really deep, there's some resources we could put in the notes. But one, I brought this all the way from Germany because I like this book so much, and I've reread it twice now. It's called The Coming Wave, and it's by an author named Mustafa Suleiman. He was part of the creators of the Transformer, ChatGPT. And his book just talks a lot about how we as society should be thinking about this new coming wave, this new technology in terms of artificial and specifically generative artificial intelligence. And so if people want to get really deep, there's some books and some free resources. Google has some free classes that anyone can take. And those are good, reputable spots that aren't going to be too biased one way or another. But yeah, I'd say keep plugging away at it.
That's great. Well, let me just say thank you for joining us today, all the way from Germany. This has just been fantastic. Yeah. Really helpful. Well, I know we could talk about a ton more. Some good practical ideas on how to start like that. I do want to set up that voice prompt function with chat or Claude just to give it a test. I'm a little curious about what it'd be like to drive down the road talking and having something respond like that. We'll see.
It can be your coach, your personal trainer in the car. I even had to give me a pep talk one day right before I said, you know, I'm going into a big meeting. You know, here's the topics. Give me a pep talk. And at the end, it was like, you're going to nail this, Stephen. You're going to
go get
great.
It.
Get it. Yeah.
I wonder how it does with taller. I wonder how it does with putting instruction. I'll have to think about that. Yeah. All right. So anyway, thank you. Thanks to our listeners today and viewers. Glad you were joining us. It's always our hope when we tackle subjects like this to deliver helpful information in a way that avoids sensationalism that sometimes, you know, accompanies things that we get from the media world out there. At Foster Group, we continue to believe that an educated optimism, it's warranted today, and that this mindset not only makes sense, but it has the benefit of helping to avoid unwarranted and unproductive worry and anxiety that can just attach to uncertainty about the future. You know, if you have any other topics that you'd like to see us address, please let us know at our website, fostergrp.com. Also, if you're enjoying our podcast, please give us a like on your podcast app and share it with your friends. Who doesn't need a little more educated optimism in their day after all? So, Stephen, thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to seeing everybody soon.
The previous presentation by Foster Group was intended for general information purposes only. No portion of the presentation serves as the receipt of, or as a substitute for, personalized investment advice from Foster Group or any other investment professional of your choosing. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk, and it should not be assumed that future performance of any specific investment or investment strategy, or any non-investment related or planning services, discussion, or content, will be profitable, be suitable for your portfolio or individual situation, or prove successful. Foster Group is neither a law firm nor accounting firm, and no portion of its services should be construed as legal or accounting advice. No portion of the content should be construed by a client or prospective client as a guarantee that he or she will experience a certain level of results if Foster Group is engaged, or continues to be engaged, to provide investment advisory services. A copy of Foster Group's current written disclosure brochure discussing our advisory services and fees is available upon request or at www.fostergrp.com/disclosures.